Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and today's program is called A Mixed Bag.
That's it. That's it. There are some links in there. There are just a few, but well, there are products. Every now and then we do get the proverbial mixed bag.
Yeah.
And I think we reckon that you probably kind of enjoy them anyway because you wonder what's going to happen next.
Right.
But to start out with, everybody loves. Who doesn't love chocolate? Don't bother to raise your hands because we can't see you anyway. but you'll kind of get the scoop when you hear Anne's introduction to this conversation with a chocolatier who comes from Venezuela.
And it's a Chual.
Chual chocolate and
Chual Michael, chocolatier.
Michael Antonossi, right? Anyway, here he is.
Well, I got on the phone with Chef Michael Antonossi and said, "You are making me fat." And he said, "Oh, no, I'm not." But
he's making me fat, too.
If Peter's getting fat, and anybody who can make Peter fat must be making pretty good chocolate. Chef Michael is co-founder Chual Chocolatier in California, but he was originally, he and his brother, who also co-founded this company, are Venezuelan. They're from Venezuela, and they're known for bean de bar chocolate, and I love it, and also for culinarily inspired flavor. Did I get that right, Michael?
You've got everything right except getting fat. I think chocolate wants to make you happy, not fat. But no, I just want to correct the fact that we're not known for bean to bar. We're known for that culinary expressions and multi-flavor and sensory experiences with chocolate.
Oh, okay. Well, but don't you, you ethically source all your beans from Venezuela, right?
Yes, not all of them, but the core of our blend is Venezuelan cacao.
Okay, so it's not a bean-to-bar operation.
No.
Okay. And most of our listeners probably don't even think of it that way anyhow.
And who knew, listeners, that Venezuela was a great source for chocolate? But in fact, it is, and historically has been for a very long time, Michael, right? I mean, Venezuela, it's not the first country that springs to mind when you think about chocolate.
Yes, the cacao actually originated in the northern coast of South America, which is right now Venezuela.
Okay.
And that's where the plant started thriving, and then there's also another plant that started thriving in the northern coast of the Amazon River, and then that sort of was the birthbed of cacao, and then it started growing all towards Central America, and now it's being done mostly in Africa.
Yeah, it was moved in, so it was really scaled up to a very large production, mostly in West Africa, correct?
That is correct, yeah.
Yeah, and Sean Askenosi takes his students at Chocolate University to Africa, doesn't he? Doesn't he, Robert?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, I think so, too. But anyhow, you have not always been a chocolatier or a chef. You have always been an entrepreneur.
That is correct. I've always wanted to create new business and just kind of grow and have fun with excitement of discovery. So at first, we did it with computer networking and telecommunications in Venezuela. We did that for 14 years, my brother and I. And then after that, I went to Paris to become a chef because that's what I wanted to do.
Now, you said to us before you came on the air that you didn't want to tell your father that after he'd helped you to get through college and do an MBA that you wanted to become a chef.
Yeah, that was going to be a hard pill to swallow. So I figure I just get some financial independence and then just go my path. And that is what we have done so far. So after being in Paris for 2 years and working at two Michelin star restaurant there for a while and specializing in chocolate and pastry making, we both wanted to go back to San Diego because we went to UC San Diego. And my brother's married to a San Diegan. So we wanted to come back here and start a new business. So we decided to go into chocolate because it was a business that makes people happy, things you don't have to explain them. And it connects with our roots in Venezuela where we have our cacao plantations there. And we used to have cacao plantations, my great-grandfather. And we've been very involved with that through our past, you know, just by having great cacao available everywhere. You know, even the commercial chocolate in Venezuela tastes much better than anywhere else. So we wanted to bring that heritage and then the European knowledge and start something fun and free as California lifestyle, mixing in ingredients, spices, and doing multi-layer sensory experiences with chocolate.
Now, is Richard also into cooking? Is he a chef? Your brother, Richard?
No, he's a computer whiz.
Okay, well, that helps.
So he's in the business side of things.
Okay. Now, let's just talk about some of these flavors. I don't know where you get ideas for these. Now, I do understand the spicy Maya hot chocolate. That I understand, natural from where you come from. But where did you get this idea of a potato chip and maple bacon bar?
Well, if you think about it, when you go to the movie theaters, at least when I go to the movie theaters, you know, I have my potatoes or popcorn and then I have some chocolate, so you go from sweet to salty. And bringing all those two things together in one chocolate sort of makes sense. If you really love potato chips and you love chocolate, well, together, it's just a better match.
Yeah, well, you just have a new, at the Fancy Food Show, you unveiled two new bars. One is Popcorn Pop, and the other one, Orange A-Go-Go. And tell us about that. Now, Popcorn Pop doesn't even have popcorn in it, does it?
Yeah, the popcorn came because some people wanted me to do something with popcorn. They said, everybody, come on, you have to do something with popcorn. Do a chocolate bar with popcorn. And I was trying to find a way to use popcorn. And then it hit me that I wanted to do something where actually you feel like popcorn is popping in your mouth. So I started mixing in some other ingredients like popping candy, which are sugar, carbonated sugar crystals, and played around with all kinds of whole grains and all these whole grains, puffed them up and tasted them, and eventually found one that tasted very much like popcorn. And it's small enough so I can use it. So I mixed that in with a little sea salt, and at the end with milk chocolate, it just comes together beautifully, and you have that beautiful crackling process going on in your mouth. And once the chocolate is gone, then you're left with this little crunchy little piece of puffed amaranth seeds, and they give you a full flavor of popcorn. So it's a pretty fun, interactive chocolate bar.
So no, that's tamarind seeds in there.
No,
right?
I just had a big piece of the Orange A-Go-Go right after lunch. Talk to us about that one.
And the Orange A-Go-Go was a bar that we wanted to do a little different. There's been other orange bars. I love orange and chocolate. We do these great orange caramelized orange peels here, and but we couldn't really get those completely in a bar, so we wanted to work on something that gives you the same experience, and we finally, using those peels and chopped up, and then using a little bergamot essence, you know, to kind of get that full citrusy aroma in dark chocolate, which is wonderful.
Is bergamot, is it actually a citrus-flavored herb?
Bergamot is an orange, so it's actually called bergamot orange. It's a type of orange that has a lot of this essential oil flavor, and it's what's used for, like, Earl Grey tea. They infuse these leaves of tea with this oil, and that's why the Earl Grey tea tastes so citrusy.
Oh, so it's not an herb, bergamot.
No, it's an orange.
That's an orange. I'm darned. Okay.
Except what you're doing is you're extracting the oil from the skin, right?
Right, right.
Now, what else are you working on? I mean, you come up with so many different ideas. What are we going to see next?
Well, that's a good question that, unfortunately, I will not be able to answer, you know, unless you wanna air this in 8 months or so.
Oh, is it that long? How long does it take to develop a new bar?
No, well, I have a bunch of stuff, a lot of fun stuff in the plate, and some of them are almost ready to go out, but we can't release information on that. You know,
no, of course not.
Like the joke says, I would have to kill you if I tell you.
I mean, everybody must be watching. You've been very successful, so people must be trying to figure out what you're trying to do next, and if you handed it to them on a plate, then you'd really be in trouble, I guess.
Yeah, that's one of the things. You know, normally I'm pretty open with all the information. I've been trying to learn to be a little more reserved. But yeah, you're right. A lot of people, they look around and they want to follow up, and then they want to take some ideas and do their own take on them, or maybe even copy them straight. But we like to think that we are constantly in the forefront, and that is the exciting part of my job, is to be able to create new things and imagining things that are familiar but exciting but unique and delicious. You know, so it's a very sweet job I have, for sure.
Yeah. Now, a lot of chocolatiers are collaborating with other artisanal producers, like Askenosi. Sean Askenosi collaborated with Jenny Splendid Ice Cream and a couple of other ones, too. And is it like some kind of a community out there of all you guys? I keep thinking of it is.
Yeah, in many ways there is. I help everyone that I can help. Anybody that wants to be a chocolatier and start a chocolate company of some sort, and I give them just about every possible advice I can think of.
But I'm talking about mashups. Like, we have Naya Gelateria, who works with Michael Ricciuti.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And also with Guittard. And
right.
I mean, with some other people. Do you do that?
Yeah, we do. We haven't done much of it. Normally, we like to be a little more reserved in terms of using the ingredients, but this could almost think that that's a new trend. I've seen it all happen, too, when I was in the Fancy Food Show, where some people are using an ingredient from another one. You know, we do it with, like, other companies in the dried fruit or freeze-dried or in the nut side. But this has been pretty creative, what I've seen out there, too, just like you're mentioning.
Tell us, let's just clarify your operation. You make the chocolate, you make the chocolate bars. Do you also have a shop?
Yes, we do. We have, right now we have two, what we call chocolate cafes, because we started making bonbons and truffles first, just very traditional European way of doing short shelf life, high-end multi-sensory little chocolate experiences. And as we started growing, we felt that we needed to do something more shelf-stable, more things that we can distribute, so we started doing bars and hot chocolate. And you know, years go by, and we started having, we had a few cafes in the area. We had to, we're left now with two that we're really pushing forward because they're our original ones. And the wholesale business has been growing dramatically. So right now we're being focused on trying to be in as many locations in the United States as possible.
Yeah, you're in Whole Foods and Crate and Barrel and Dean and DeLuca. I mean, those are all top names.
Yeah. And, well, you know, we feel in the democratizing the accessibility of chocolate. So you want to make sure that you can find our chocolate pretty much near your house without sacrificing any quality of it. Same chocolate, it's the same product, and it's delicious every time. So if you go to Whole Foods, get it there. If you happen to be a Crate and Barrel, get it there. If you happen to be in a different location or on the web, you can always buy and we ship.
Yeah, that's www.chuaochocolatier.com is the website, and it's very witty. Who writes all that? Your brother?
The cute copy. Oh, that's Brooke. Brooke is our writer.
Okay, well,
she's a creative mind that is pretty fun.
Yeah, well, it's fun just wandering around your website.
Now, is there a store finder on the website?
Chocolate. There's a store finder. Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You can find. Put your zip code, and it'll tell you where we are around you.
Because chocolate's sort of like a spontaneous buy, isn't it? After all,
it is. Yeah. Or you can have your particular route where you say, "I'm going to stop here because I want to get this and that and get my chocolate."
Aha. That's Amy's chocolates business, right?
Yeah.
I mean, she has people who come in to buy a new chocolate bar every day or so.
Yeah. You know, and there's people that go buy one, taste it in the car, and then have to go back in and buy 10.
I can picture that. I can picture myself with my arms tied behind my back, trying to figure out how to open the bars with my teeth.
But, you know, and you do something else that's different from what a lot of people do today. You have not abandoned milk chocolate.
No, actually, I find it, and I'm not doing it with any purpose, but the fact that it just works well with the combination that we're doing. So it's not really following a statistical trend in any sort. It's just that if I'm doing a mix with this, like the popcorn pop, I did it in dark and in milk, and it just hands down, you know, the milk beat the dark.
Yeah, you decided so, that or did sales
right, like the orange that. Go, well, that definitely works with dark. I am working on like three more flavor profiles, and they all are working in milk. So it's just what really works for the experience, what matters to me. I'm not really going into the health benefits of the darkest chocolate. Chocolate for us is it's a main ingredient in our confection, but it has to play well with all the other parts. So it's supposed to be a pleasurable, enjoyable, fun experience. And it's not really kind of a intellectual trip where you try to figure out the percentages and the origins and the complexities of something that it's really intended to make you happy and feel joy of eating something that is really delicious and gives you all the, and you can pay attention and you get all these layers of textures and flavors and things happening in time. So pretty engaging chocolate.
It's the food of the gods, of that there's no doubt. And Michael is 6 feet tall and weighs in around 145 pounds. So it's not a conspiracy. All you have to do is regulate.
Exactly, yeah. You know, we have the bars, the little bars are 50 calories. It's all a matter of, you know.
Yeah, but Michael, how many do they eat? I mean, these people claim there's only 50 calories and they eat 20 of them.
That's the thing. But you want to eat just one a day or so. But if you eat one every day, that's fine.
Oh, you're wonderful. Anyhow, well, I really, I look forward to seeing what the new flavors are going to be.
Oh, they're
going to
be exciting. I'm really excited. I'm so excited, it's hard for me not to tell you.
Well, I was going to say, could you whisper it to me once we're off air?
Well, I do. Send us some. We promise we won't tell.
No, I can't. It's too close.
Okay, well, in that case, you must call us.
Yeah, once we have it done and ready, we'll let you know for sure.
Come on back and you can talk about it again.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story, your passion, and your wonderful gift to humanity.
Well, thank you guys for sharing it with humanity. You know, we just, I believe that chocolate can make people happy, and the more people are happy, the more happy the community is going to be. So let's make them all happy.
Well, it's the kind of chocolate that smiles in every bar.
Yeah.
You can have that as a new slogan if you'd like.
Smiles in every bar?
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right.
Smiles in every bite.
maybe not my best effort there.
Yeah.
Anyhow, Michael, thank you, and I'll talk to you when you have a new flavor.
Absolutely. Thank you guys too.
And right after the break, we'll be back with how you can make sweet treats for yourself.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, welcome back. Here is an entire book on a single subject that I didn't expect. And it's called Cookies and Cream. And basically, it's ice cream sandwiches.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing that there can be so much to be said about it.
Right.
But this is a really fascinating author and a very interesting book, if this is your inclination.
Tessa Arias is a chef who loves desserts, and for some reason she loves particularly the combination of ice cream and cookies. I've had a lot of single subject cookbooks across my desk, Tessa, but this is the first one with cookies and cream, ice cream sandwiches. Tell us how you hit on this.
Well, basically, like you said, there are a bunch of single subject dessert cookbooks out on the market right now, but I found that there weren't any that combined cookies and ice cream, and you really do get the best of both worlds with that combination. And I just found that with the endless flavor combinations that you can create with ice cream sandwiches, I thought it would make a really fun subject matter for a cookbook.
Now, ice cream sandwiches, you're more expert than I am, because we eat very little ice cream around the Hague household.
I used to love ice cream.
But you can get ice cream sandwiches as a commercial product, but sort of rather limited, right?
Yes, and you know, I find with a lot of commercially purchased ice cream sandwiches, the flavors are really lacking. They're often very bland. And the texture, they're sitting in the ice cream fridge, they're like cardboard, or they're very soggy. And so when you make your own ice cream sandwiches, you can choose what kind of textures you want. And I really developed all the cookie recipes in this book to hold their shape after being frozen, and also to remain soft in the freezer so you don't crack a tooth or anything like that when you go to bite into your sandwich.
All right, but the first step in a great ice cream sandwich is to make great ice cream, right? So you start out with some excellent, or what seemed to me, not being expert at all, seemed to be extremely important tips about how to make sure you're making a right ice cream properly.
Yes, in the book I detail all the different ways to make ice cream, and a lot of the recipes are custard-based, so you'll cook your ice cream ingredients, which include eggs and sugar and cream and milk and whatever flavorings, and by cooking that mixture together, you get a really nice, thick, luscious, creamy ice cream that's full of flavor and is not icy or hard at all.
I wanted to ask you about this because, I mean, I know the difference between gelato and ice cream, and I know what sorbet is and so forth. But when we interviewed Jenny of Jenny's Ice Cream, I had never paid attention. She doesn't use egg in any of her ice creams, and I just always thought that ice cream by definition had a custard base, and you use custard, she doesn't. What is the difference in the result?
Well, I've never had the pleasure of tasting her ice cream before, so I can't exactly compare it, but in my experience, when you make ice cream with just the cream and sugar and whatever other ingredients you're using, when it goes into the freezer, it can often get hard and crystallized because there's not enough fat in the ice cream itself to make it nice and smooth and creamy. So a custard-based ice cream really gives you the best texture possible without having to use any commercial stabilizers or additives that you find in the grocery store.
Huh. We certainly don't want any stabilizers or...
No, good to grief.
That's terrible. That's terrible.
No, you should really get a hold of something of Jenny's because it's rather extraordinary stuff.
I've heard rave reviews.
Oh, please. I mean, she said she can look out the window of her kitchen and see the cows grazing that she uses for her ice cream, for the cream.
Yeah, she puts cows in ice cream. That's unusual.
Yeah, well, that is unusual. New flavor.
So like Chick-fil-A. don't eat more ice cream, whatever you do.
So, anyhow, I love ice cream, actually, but I don't eat it often enough to invest in an ice cream maker. Is there anything you could do short of having an ice cream maker?
There is a method that you can use without an ice cream maker, and it's not going to produce as creamy of results. Basically, you make your ice cream mixture up, and you stick it in the freezer, and you come back and you stir it every couple of minutes to agitate it and to give you kind of that, kind of incorporate air into the mixture so that it's nice and airy and creamy. Oh, but, wow. You know, there are a lot of ice cream makers now in the market that you can buy for less than $50. So it's not a huge investment for a lot of people.
Yeah, so if you're serious about ice cream sandwiches and ice cream in general, basically the entry price is buy yourself an ice cream maker or get one on eBay or something, right?
Oh, definitely. Ask for one for your birthday or Christmas. They make great gifts, too.
Oh, I wish that could have given our kids.
Now, help us understand how you approach this. Having given lots and lots of tips on how to make the very best ice cream, which mm-hmm. is a value in and of itself, I guess, how do you then go about explaining the process of making the different kinds of ice cream sandwiches that you cover?
Well, there's plenty of different cookie recipes, and some of them are drop-style cookies where you make the dough and you just roll it into balls and bake it off, and there are some recipes that you make the cookie dough and you roll it out and cut up shapes, which can be really fun and cute for different festive occasions. But in general, I think the best part about making ice cream sandwiches is that if you're making them from scratch, it does take a little bit more work than if you were to purchase it at a grocery store. But so many of the steps in the process can be done ahead of time. So it's really great if you are busy or if you're planning to entertain and want to serve ice cream sandwiches at a party in a few days. Literally every single step along the way can be finished ahead of time. So it's really nice in that way.
So it's like some assembly required, but not very much.
Yes,
When it's time to put it on the table.
And the nice thing that I found is that ice cream sandwiches, when they're assembled, as long as they're individually wrapped in plastic wrap, they will stay good in your freezer for up to a week. So if you have a party on Friday, you could make your ice cream sandwiches the Monday before and just stick them in the freezer, take them out 10 minutes before you're ready to serve, and they'll be perfect.
Talk to us about how you organized this book with your different sections.
I had so many ideas when I started writing this book, so many recipe ideas and flavor combinations running through my head, and I thought it would be really fun to section it off into chapters that describe the sandwich. And so if you are a chocoholic like I am, there's a whole section on chocolate ice cream sandwiches. If you prefer something more fresh tasting, there's a whole chapter on fruity ice cream sandwiches. I have ice cream sandwiches divided into holidays, so that you have an ice cream sandwich to turn to for each and every occasion. And I think my favorite chapter of all, though, might be the sinful ice cream sandwiches,
yes.
Which are just over-the-top indulgences.
Give us some ideas of some of those.
One that is a family favorite in my family is the red velvet ice cream sandwich, which is red velvet cookie with cream cheese ice cream.
Oh, wow.
That's a real fun one.
Now, what about the Elvis?
The Elvis, oh yes. The Elvis is a combination of peanut butter ice cream and banana cookies, and the edges of the sandwich are rolled in crumbled bacon.
Yeah, I saw that. I wasn't so sure about the crumbled bacon.
Yeah, we had
I know it sounds a little weird, but I promise you it's delicious.
No, we had a guest on the show, just a slight divergence. We had a guest on the show who claimed that she had slept with Elvis Presley, and the thing that surprised her the most is that right after he ordered a bacon sandwich from room service.
That's Gail Green.
Yeah,
you know Gail Green, don't you?
So we don't know how you know that Elvis Presley liked bacon. we're a little suspicious.
Well, I can tell you, I'm a little too young to have that intimate of knowledge.
Yeah, well, you know Gail Green, the former New York Magazine critic?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyhow.
Well, this is her story.
This is her story. Insatiable is her bio.
I haven't read it.
you know, you'll pick up some good tips. Tell you a lot of people she slept with. Anyhow,
that assumes she's interested, which I doubt very much.
I
doubt very much if Tessa is interested.
Back to these sandwiches.
Okay,
I was looking at the cannoli sandwich, which looked absolutely gorgeous. The presentation is so pretty. And this is not even in the sinful section, the turtle ice cream sandwich.
Oh, yeah.
that one looks sinful.
It is. It very much is.
So, but you don't have that in the sinful section.
I think ice cream sandwiches in general are a little sinful, aren't they?
I think so. Now, what's your absolute favorite?
That is a tough one, but I think I will have to say just the classic chocolate chip ice cream sandwich, which in my book is chocolate chip cookies with butterscotch ice cream, and the edges are rolled in chocolate chips. And I just love that butterscotch flavor that plays off of the cookie
good.
And the ice cream.
That sounds super. And I think I'd take that one over your Halloween ice cream, but then I'm not really big on candy corn.
You know, neither was I, and I was just playing around in the kitchen, and I thought, I think this is possible, candy corn ice cream.
Yeah.
And to my surprise, I actually enjoyed it, and so did my family, even though we aren't big fans of candy corn, but I think anyone's children on Halloween would especially love that recipe.
Well, this is a little bit like the corn sundae that you had in London.
I was just thinking of that. Yeah. Take a look at our website, Tessa, under the OTM and pictures, because this shows something you'd be really interested in, is in London at a Peruvian restaurant, I had a corn sundae. Which included caramel popcorn, among other things.
Anne has told everybody for the 9 years that On the Menu has been on the air that she hates dessert. So I captured a picture of her demolishing this corn sundae. That's worth the price of admission anyway. But I'm sure you can do something with the flavor ideas that came out of that, because it truly was it tasted better than it looked, and it looked rather magnificent.
So anyhow, wow. Tessa, are you going into pastry chefing? Or
no, I'm not sure. I think I would like to, but I'm not sure if I can get at that. The crack of dawn every morning.
Oh, yeah, or in the middle of the night, I remember.
That's tough.
I remember, what was it, the Hip and Mass, that this pastry chef, we were doing a James Beard House dinner, and en route from Pittsburgh to New York, her Hip and Mass fell. So she had to get up in the middle of the night.
And make another one.
Make another batch.
She was very dedicated.
Oh, yeah.
Andrea Shrink. She was. Andrea gets a prize for being dedicated.
Oh, God. Anyhow, so are you working on your next book?
Not yet. This one was like my first child. It took a lot of work, and I think I just wanted to see what would happen when it came out before I started thinking about any other projects like it.
Good idea. Take a little break here. Well, it's been a delight to talk to you. And,
oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I really would like some of these right now. Dolce de leche.
Well, our first stop will be somewhere to buy an ice cream machine.
I'll have to send you one.
Yeah. Have a great day, Tessa. Thank you so much for being part of On the Menu.
Oh, thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Well, Tessa sure is nothing if she's not an enthusiast, right?
Yes, indeed.
And I'll bet some of you are going to go out and buy this book and get some ingredients.
I already have one taker for that book.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. I have no question about that. But stay with us, because we're going to go a little savory after the next break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Thanks for staying with us. Next up is Mike Babcock, who may be our new best friend because he makes such great products, soups and curries. And he's from Oregon, and that's like one of my favorite places. And I think if the weather were any better, I'd be living there.
Yeah, well, they do love to make nice things in Oregon.
Oh,
don't they?
Boy.
And they have a fine larder of both wild and cultivated products.
And this is a gem, Oregon Seafoods.
Oregon Seafoods is a gem. The aegis of the program itself is interesting. So listen closely. Maybe you can make something like this happen in your neck of the woods.
Well, you know, Peter, I think that you ought to introduce our next guest because you've eaten up all of his soups already.
I have. I have one left. I've only been saving it because I couldn't bear the thought of not having any more, because this product from Oregon Seafoods.
Brand name itself is Seafare, F-A-R-E, Pacific. And we're talking to the CEO, are you, Mike?
I am. I'm the owner.
Mike Babcock, and you founded it as well. And how far into the company history are you? How old is this company?
We're relatively young. The company itself is about 3 years old. We started out co-packing for some other brands and then decided to launch our own brand, Seafare Pacific, about a year and a half ago.
But you got the recipe from what seemed to us like an unusual place. Explain.
You know, we started out packing fish products, albacore and salmon and things like that. But this last spring, last winter, we started R&D. We contacted Oregon Sea Grant, which is part of Oregon State University up in Astoria. And we worked with a food scientist there by the name of Mark Whittem. And he had been in development himself for quite some time on a specific line of seafood-based soups and sauces.
Now, why was that seems like an unusual choice, even for Oregon, which has a lot of coastline.
Well, their mission in life, Sea Grant Oregon, is to develop or utilize seafood in different ways.
Oh, okay, so that's their research mission.
That's right.
Okay, all right.
Well, sure, good stuff. You're not a foodie by background, though, are you?
I'm not, actually.
No, you're
I come
you're
from the sawmill background.
From what?
I come from the sawmill industry, and actually I grew up a farmer.
Oh, yeah? Well, that's
so
close.
I don't really have a foodie-type background at all.
And then you were a packer.
That's right.
You know, I found the best tuna fish I ever had my whole entire life came from a fisherman in Oregon, and I had his phone number, and he didn't have any electronic communication whatsoever. And every time I called to get more of this stuff, nobody answered. He had no answering machine, nothing. But he was out on a boat all the time catching this stuff.
But I think you lost his number anyway, didn't you?
I guess so. I know where
but,
I could get it again.
But I remember now, one time we were out in Portland, I guess we had albacore tuna was on lots and lots of restaurant menus because it was a time of the year when albacore tuna runs off the coast.
And usually that's from late June, early July.
Okay.
Through the end of October. And so we haven't seen fish yet. We think they're out about 100 miles, but they're moving closer, and our season's just getting ready to ramp up.
Isn't this exciting, huh?
Right. It is exciting every year.
Yeah. And in addition to the soups, you make curries. Why curries? Why did you choose curries?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm not a curry fan myself, but this is probably more Oregon State and their development. When they approached me with the curries, I sampled out their samples to a few people, and the reaction I got was incredible. They just loved the product. And so I know that there's a huge following for curry, and the product that we produce, a shelf-stable pouch, is simply a heat-and-serve product. There's a need for that in the Asian aisle of the store, and so that's what drove us to introduce the curries as well.
Well, your soups are that way, too. I mean, explain that whole thing. I mean, they're so convenient.
Sure. You know, we're a plant that produces shelf-stable products, and we do that by retorting them, cooking them in the pouch, and in a sense gives us like a two-year-plus shelf life on the product. And what's unique about this is that there's lots of different soups and sauces that have the provision to add the fish to them after the fact. With our products, the fish is in the pouch. So similar to clam chowder, that's probably the closest thing people would associate with us with. You see clam chowder, you know, clear across the country, and it has the clams in the pouch.
Yeah.
But you really don't see any other products. Maybe some local artisanal brand, but most of those are either going to be a refrigerated product or they're going to be a canned product. It'll be like a like a base where it's a concentrate. Ours is already mixed and in the right consistency in that pouch. Simply put it in the microwave, or you can cook it stovetop or boil it in the pouch as well. But it's ready to go. Just heat and serve.
It's one of only two reasons I can think of to use the microwave. I mean, it's... You know, we get lots and lots of products, I must say, and I'm so used to Peter turning his nose up at all this prepared food because we're both excellent cooks.
Well,
he went crazy over the soup. I have
Most canned soup is I mean, it's really
terrible.
It's really bland.
Right. Well, let me tell you, the part of it probably is the ingredients, and of course the formulation has a large part to do with it, but you know, we specifically seek out non-GMO ingredients, and that forces us to use organic in many instances. And then we use high-quality, in the curries, for instance, we use a very high-quality coconut cream, the best we can get our hands on. So we think that, you know, it's a combination of the recipe and the ingredients that we use that really does the job.
But, I mean, the recipe's at the core of it, right? So whoever did this...
Well, he's saying the ingredients are at the core of it.
Oh, okay. Well, I think the recipe makes all those things intersect.
That's right.
Is really the key.
Yeah, I think they both go hand in hand. I think you need to start out with clean, fresh ingredients, and then you need to put them in that pouch in the right combination, and that's what. And that took months and months and months of development to get it just right. Not only the way it tastes, but the way it works on your palate, the way it works on your tongue, the different flavor profiles, the way it smells, the way it looks, the color profile. And we've done that with natural type ingredients, and it really is something fantastic.
I'm glad you think so, too, because you sure know a lot about this not being a foodie background person.
Now,
you have all the right answers there. I mean, everything we would be looking at in the soup is right there in your pouch.
Right, and we're pretty jazzed about it.
Yeah. Now, where will you be going? You're not going to stop here, right?
You mean with products?
Yes, yes.
No, we have several products in R&D as we speak.
Okay.
And we're looking at more items that add value to seafood. And our business is Oregon Seafoods. And we look for sustainable, clean, healthy fish products that we can take and develop into tasty, healthy meals. So, again, we're working on several things. And this next year, we plan to introduce some more things and just keep going.
So how do people get a hold of these? I guess I should ask, first of all, as high-end as it is quality-wise, is it also expensive?
You know, I don't know. I hear by some people that is extremely reasonable price, and then I hear by others that, hey, that's a little on the pricey side. Those 9-ounce pouches, the suggested retail on them is $6.99.
Oh, wow, that's cheap.
Now,
for that quality.
There are some venues that have those pouches as cheap as $5.99, depending on the distribution model. But our suggest is $6.99. And right now, they're primarily on the West Coast, of course. We're talking to several accounts on the East Coast. Sprouts down the southwest of the U.S., they've taken both the bisque and the smoked salmon chowder, and they will start receiving those products, I think, within a few weeks. And so there's lots of things happening. There's lots of excitement at the shows, and buyers are excited. They love the samples, and we're just now starting to ramp up.
Now, is there a store finder on your website?
There is. It's not specific to the soups currently. That's something we need to work on.
But there
is a store finder at seafarepacific.com.
Seafarepacific.com. That's SEAFARE. Pacific, PACIFIC.
You got it.
.com, right.
You got
great.
It.
And do you do online ordering?
We don't do it ourselves. We sell to some other online vendors. If you Google it, you'll find it. There's several out there now that actually have the soups in inventory, and they are selling them online.
Well, I can tell you this, Mike. It's so wonderful to be able to be enthusiastic about a brand you've just discovered. And we are certainly really high on your... The chowders and bisques that we've tried.
Thank you.
And isn't it wonderful to report that higher education is actually doing something useful for a change? Oops, I never said that. No, bite my tongue off. Thank you so much for joining us today. Come back in a year or so and tell us more about all the great products you've added to the line.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
And you'll be smiling after the next conversation too, I feel sure, because I'll give you a clue. Say cheese is involved, but not quite in the same way as you might think.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again, and I guess what you really meant, Rabbit, when you said something about say cheese, is that that's the subject
of the next
as opposed to taking photographs, right? Okay,
yes, exactly.
Well,
exactly.
Next we have a story of a really nice business. It's in its family, fourth generation, DeBruno Brothers House of Cheese, which when I lived in Philadelphia, I must have walked past it every time I was in the 9th Street Market.
You probably went in there and shopped, knowing
I probably did. And anyhow, so the author is Tanya Darlington, which I thought she made up, but it's not.
and her life's quite a story, too. But the real story is the cheese. So if you're a cheese freak, hang on. Listen carefully. If you're not a cheese freak, you're about to become one by listening to this fascinating story.
Tanya Darlington is a writer, a writing professor, a published writer, a novelist, among other things, and also has a book out called DeBruno Brothers House of Cheese, which is what we're going to talk about today, which is essentially family history but a cheese guide with tips on pairing and so forth. And Tanya, I said you have to be an author with a name like Tanya Darlington anyhow. So you did a good job with that, picking your career.
Thank you.
But back to this book. You moved from Wisconsin, which is not an unknown territory for cheese, to Philadelphia.
That's right.
Did you take your cheese head with you?
I did not. I left that back in Wisconsin. I came in search of the real stuff.
Well, we've had some really excellent cheeses from Wisconsin. I can't remember. There's one particularly fine maker.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember the name. They only make like two or three kinds of cheese.
Yeah, I mean, they started one, and then he did a soft cheese.
You're probably thinking of Upland.
Upland.
Yeah,
right.
Andy Hatt. Beautiful cheeses.
Yeah, we've interviewed him. He's amazing.
Sure.
Okay, so anyway, so then you thought you knew about cheese.
That's right.
Until you walked into a cheese shop, and then you knew that you knew next to nothing.
Right. Well, I don't know if it was next to nothing, but it certainly whetted my appetite to try more kinds of cheese. I moved from Wisconsin in 2005, and I didn't know a single person in Philadelphia. But former neighbor in Wisconsin had given me the address to DeBruno Brothers' 9th Street location in the Italian Market. And so my first week in Philadelphia, I showed up and I actually asked for Upland's Pleasant Ridge Reserve at the counter. And they said, "Whoa, who are you? How do you know about that cheese?"
Oh, there you go. So they realized you knew something.
Well, I had worked for a newspaper in Wisconsin, and so I'd run the food section for a newspaper, and so I'd met a number of cheesemakers, and I was really excited by some of the small artisans working with Wisconsin Milk. So when I moved to Philadelphia, I was curious if there was a Pennsylvania cheese, and I was curious if I would be able to get some of those wonderful Wisconsin cheeses here. So that's where my journey began.
Well, I guess you impressed them out of the box by picking one they knew was really good.
Well, they said, "If you like that, well, then you have to try this, and you must try that." So they led me down the path. They knew that I was hooked.
So first of all, you didn't just start a book. You started with a blog.
That's right. I started taking some notes on a weekly basis at the cheese counter because I would try new things and I would want to remember all the information that I was being given. And then as I began to make friends in the Philadelphia area, I started taking cheese boards, parties, and people said, "You always bring such wonderful cheeses, but we can never remember what they are by the end of the night." So they said, "If you do a blog, photos and names, we would be able to go buy them ourselves." So it started out as a little service for friends. Gradually, it became a way for me to explore small batch cheeses being made in the United States, but also internationally, that I felt were really special.
So you had some parameters at the very beginning of your search.
Well, I decided I would try to eat my way through the entire DeBruno Brothers cheese case. And the DeBruno's House of Cheese, their original location, has this beautiful cheese counter. And, I don't know, there's probably 180, 200 cheeses in there at any one time.
And most of them found their way into your book.
Most of them did.
Now, you said about this in a variety of different ways. First of all, it's, in a way, it's sort of like a memoir of the family, which founded the business.
In 1939.
Yes.
It's a really, truly remarkable effort.
They have an amazing story. You know, it was Danny and Joe DeBruno, who were Italian immigrants, came to this country with only a third grade education, and they set up what was, at the time, like a little grocery, and then eventually they moved into cheese and Italian imports, of course, because in the Italian market, everybody wanted their Italian specialties. So now it's third-generation owners, and they've really expanded into a wide variety of specialty foods, but cheese is really still the heart of their business.
And they also came from Abruzzo, which was not very sophisticated as an area.
They did come from Abruzzo, yeah.
Yeah.
But they probably had a lot of cheese.
They traveled later in life to Switzerland and saw big wheels of Gruyere and became interested in sort of international cheeses along with Italian cheeses.
We were in Abruzzo, one of our trips to Abruzzo, and we were driving through the mountains of Abruzzo, and somebody said, you know, it would really be fun if you could see one of these great herds of sheep. They have this, I don't know what you call it, an event called the Transhumanza.
Oh, okay. Transhumanists.
And they move the sheep into the mountains in the summertime, and then they bring them back closer to the farms in the wintertime. But in between times, these huge herds of sheep roam the mountains of Abruzzo with a particularly fierce kind of sheepdog protecting them.
Ah.
And we were in a lay-by on a mountain road setting up to take photographs of this wonderful flock of sheep. And all of a sudden, the flock of sheep moved towards us threateningly.
And well, the dogs moved.
The sheep dogs
moved
in the lead.
Attack you.
And Anne said, "Why are you still taking pictures?" I said, "This is a great picture. This is an absolutely great picture."
She's saying,
"Get in the car and get out of here." now the picture is on our website.
Oh,
and the good news is, you can tell is that we did get away.
right. Did you get to try some wonderful sheep's milk cheese?
We've had wonderful cheeses from around the world because we love cheese so much, and we've been to so many different places.
Sure.
We're always looking to sample something new and interesting. But
now, how did you organize your book?
Well, I had read many, many cheese books that were organized along very technical lines.
Usually
milk type or cheese style. And I just didn't think that made sense for the general cheese lover. So I got this idea to organize the cheeses into personalities.
I was just going to say personalities.
Yeah.
I'm looking right now at Mountain Men. Give us some other examples.
Oh, there's Vixens. Those are the triple creams. A lot of the goat cheeses are housed under Free Spirits, the chapter called Free Spirits.
Sugar Mamas.
Sugar Mamas, those are the sweet cheeses, dessert cheeses. Pierced Punks was my term for blue cheeses, since those cheeses are actually pierced with long nails in order to create an oxidation process for the blue cheese.
You have one called, is it Stinkies?
We have Stinkers,
Stinkers.
Yeah. I mean, those are usually washed rind cheeses is the term that is used in the cheese world. But I feel like a lot of people don't understand some of that terminology, but they know what a stinker is and whether or not they want to try it.
Yeah, we have a photograph of a cheese shop in the Adelaide, South Australia market, which is a wonderful market. But the name of the business is the Stinky Cheese Company.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. I've seen them online.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
You so they're not just famous in South Australia.
Nope, they get around.
Now, one of the things that I think you contribute more strongly than I've seen in any other cheese books, and we've seen lots of them, is that you speak very lovingly about the extent to which cheeses in the United States have improved and that they now are world class.
Oh, they are. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we know that. A lot of people don't know that. And you come right out and say, but this is the way it is.
Exactly. I try to make a distinction between craft cheeses with a K and craft cheese with a C, meaning, handcrafted cheeses. And there are so many wonderful examples in the United States. But you're right. A lot of people feel that to buy good cheese means they have to buy a European cheese. And today there are just so many exquisite American cheeses coming out of small farms that I wanted to draw attention to them.
Now, so where are some of the places? Immediately what springs to mind in our mind is the Northwest and also Vermont. Two far places far away from each other.
Sure.
And yet there must be other states too.
Oh, there are. Indiana has a wonderful goat cheese operation called Capriel Farm, and the cheesemaker there makes one of my favorite little goat cheeses called Wabash Cannonball. Very iconic little goat cheeses, just beautiful. When I see them at the cheese counter, I always just, it sends a shiver down my spine to see these beautiful little American cheeses that most people would take a look at and probably think these are from France because, you know, they're covered in ash, they're very rustic looking, they're in an unusual shape, they don't have that sort of processed look. So that's one example, you know, coming out of rural Indiana. There are good cheeses coming out of Ohio, out of West Virginia, out of Iowa. I mean, I could think of just about every state, and I can picture some cheese that's really wonderful coming out of a farmstead situation.
Now, here's an interesting one for you, and I don't know if you're familiar with this. I don't even remember what kind of cheese it was, but Chef John Foss, who's a very famous chef in New Orleans in the South, and he decided to reinvent the making of cheese in Louisiana,
which had
died out for like a couple of hundred years. So he decided he would start making this cheese, and then on a joke, on a whim, he entered one of his cheeses in the World Cheese, I guess it's the British Cheese Festival.
Okay.
And he won in his category.
Oh, wow. Do you remember the name of the cheese?
I honestly don't remember.
Ah, I'll have to look it up.
Yeah, if you look up Chef John Foss and cheese, I'm sure you'll find it.
Oh, fascinating.
And the other guys we love are from Rogue River.
Oh, for
the
sure.
The Rogue guys are fantastic.
Their blues are incredible.
They have a new, like, crumbled stuff that sounds not so good to me.
Yeah, it's like a blue cheese powder. I just had it on some popcorn at the Cheesemonger Invitational in New York last weekend.
And
it's pretty good on popcorn, I have to say. Mostly I go for the real deal.
You do, okay.
Well, now, the Cheesemonger Festival, was this tied in with the Fancy Food Show?
It was the night before the Fancy Food Show on the Friday night. Cheesemongers come in from all over the United States, and they compete against one another in being able to identify cheese in blind tasting,
able
to wrap cheese, and being able to break down Parmesans. It's all in good fun, but there is a lot of competition.
Yeah, well. Now, one question that I had was competition. You talk about competition. The competition in terms of cheese guidebooks is so intense. You have all the big guns weighing in on this. How did you feel that you'd be able to stand up to this competition, like Max McCallman and all these other people?
I know. Well, I've spent many years reading cheese guides, and I love the variety of information that's out there. You know, Max McCallman has such a voice, so does Laura Werlin, Janet Fletcher, Patricia Michelson. I think that one of the things that I love about so many of those books is that they're so beautifully written and they contain such useful information. So I wasn't trying to repeat anything that they had already done other than to write my own version of a well-written, enticing cheese book. I wanted to make it really fun, though, and a little bit unpredictable. And so that's why I tried to take a very different kind of approach. De Bruyne Brothers' House of Cheese is about the personality behind cheeses. It's about pairings. We tried to provide a beer and wine pairing for every cheese in the book, which is something that none of the other books have done. So we just tried to take it in a slightly different direction, which was to emphasize playing with cheese, entertaining with cheese, and not necessarily just knowing the facts.
Now, there's one gentleman that you quote a lot in the book with little sort of snippets, little sidebars. I can't remember his name now.
Probably Hunter Fite.
Right.
Yeah, so he actually wrote those sidebars. He's one of the cheesemongers from the Bruner Brothers who was so instrumental in teaching me about cheese. So I asked him if he would write some of the book with me.
And he did a lovely job.
He really did. Thank you.
Here's a man who clearly loves his cheese.
Yes.
He probably has cheese for breakfast.
Well, he even has a child named James Montgomery after James Montgomery's famous cheddar.
Well, now that brings me back to something else that's really very interesting. And I saw it really beautifully emphasized in your book, because it seems like even in the European countries, which have a huge tradition of cheese making, nevertheless, cheese making fell into decline.
Right.
and has had to be reinvented. And you talk about several different varieties, like Lincoln's Poacher is one that I noticed, where essentially it wasn't made for centuries.
Right.
And all of a sudden some young cheesemakers decided that they wanted to make a cheese in that style. And
right.
I guess somehow or other they figured out what the recipe was, and now they're making it on a small scale, but a really wonderful cheese.
Sure. During the Industrial Revolution and during wartime, a lot of these small traditional cheese styles died out, and cheese makers were enlisted to produce, an England government cheddar. And it's only now that families are going back and discovering traditional recipes maybe passed down from a grandmother or from a great aunt and are beginning to revive these traditional styles. It's become very popular to do that. And it's been exciting to sort of be on the forefront of watching these old-style cheeses appear, often by families who once were involved in these cottage industries. And, Spark and Hole Red Leicester is an example. So is, you just mentioned a cheese, and it now slips my mind. But it's just another example.
Lincolnshire Poacher.
Lincolnshire Poacher, yeah, of a cheese style that was very well known and beloved by the community around it, and then it died out, and now it's coming back.
Yeah, the Red Leicester was one of the samples that De Bruno sent us.
Oh, fantastic.
And it's really delicious. But it's not just Red Leicester. It's a Red Leicester produced by a particular maker who's especially concerned to make sure that he gets it just the way he wants it to be.
Right, right, and that it keeps to tradition.
No, it's really funny. When you think about cheddar, one of the nasty words that comes along is craft with a K.
Right. She mentioned that already.
Yeah, I know, but I'm coming back to it now. And remembering when we first read Max McCalman's book, where he ranks some 200 cheeses and describes why he thinks this one is better than that one.
Right.
And Montgomery Cheddar is number two.
Right. What is it for number one, just out of curiosity?
Number one is another cheddar. No, it's another cheddar producer.
Oh, is it?
Oh.
It's a cheddar, producer in Berkshire, I think.
Who was the one that wanted the name? Who was the guy who started Murray's Cheese?
Rob Kaufelt?
Murray's Cheese?
Yeah. What's his name, Rob?
Rob Kaufelt, I think.
No, he worked there, and then he broke out and had his own.
Steve Jenkins.
Steve Jenkins, yeah.
There we go.
I think he lists Parmesan as the number one, doesn't
okay.
he?
Yeah, we read separately altogether. I can't remember what we did it about this cheese called Stilton, which is a raw milk Stilton.
Right.
And these particular people are making it, and no one else will make it. In fact, you can't make a raw milk Stilton and call it Stilton anymore. They had to come up with another name.
Right, because the legal standards have changed, so it's written now as law to be called Stilton. It's written now in law that it has to be pasteurized. But originally, the original makers would have used raw milk. So
Colton Bassett, I guess, is at the top of the makers of traditional or traditional changed and regulated Stilton.
Did you eat any of that the Magadi cheese in Sardinia?
No, I didn't. People ask about that all the time.
I never did
across that, only in videos.
I never could. I absolutely couldn't.
I'm not sure I even like a video of it, to tell you
the truth.
No. I think you have to be raised with something like that.
It's like we were listening to a chef in London talk about that Noma dessert that has the live ants in it.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
He said he didn't like it all that well.
No.
He said he kept looking, and the ants kept raising their little arms, saying, "Don't eat me! Don't eat me!"
Yeah.
Well, here's my question here, Tanaya: is you now have all of this information, this knowledge, cheese? How will you use it in the future?
Well, I tell you, I've been using it just about every day. I'm an educator, so I teach creative writing courses, and I teach a food writing course at St. Joseph's University here in Philadelphia. And when I'm not teaching, about imagery and poetry, I often do tastings or cheese classes in the Philadelphia area.
Do you really?
So, yeah. We've just done a number of those recently off of the book, And one of the things I like to do is give people a small bite from each chapter. So I have a little cheese 101 class I've devised where you taste 10 samples of cheese and you get sort of a range of the different cheeses out there and the different personalities. And my idea is then if you can find one or two cheeses from the samples you really like, and you can pursue some of those cheese personalities and begin to explore more broadly.
Now, have you met any of the people that you write about in your book? Like, did you ever get to actually meet Mary Keane?
Mary Keane, I've never met in person, but I've met a number of other cheesemakers. I know a lot of Pennsylvania area cheesemakers and some New York cheesemakers. Just recently, I met James Montgomery. He came through town just last week prior to the Fancy Food Show, along with a few other cheesemakers who sell a lot of their wheels through the Bruno Brothers.
Uh-huh.
So that's always a great honor.
Aren't they interesting?
They are. So down to earth.
Yeah, who's the one? Angela Miller, the goat cheese lady.
I've never met her.
Did you read her book?
I don't know that I've read her book.
Read the book. I can't remember what it's called.
She's the one who's a big-time PR person, but she bought a farm?
Yeah, she's actually a book agent. In New York, but
okay.
She bought this farm in Vermont, and then she had a fillet, and then she got some goats, and then she and it went from there, and then she made cheese, and the book is delightful because I mean she's sophisticated, literarily sophisticated as well.
Oh, fantastic! Well, thanks for the suggestion.
We can't remember the name of her farm. But if you go through our On the Menu OTM Audio Archive website and look for
name.
Angela Miller, you'll find it.
It's that guy.
Something Bardwell.
Oh, yes, Consider Bardwell.
Consider Bardwell.
Now.
That's right.
Ah, fantastic.
Yeah. Anyhow, well, you have a lot of fun then. I'm glad to see you continue having fun since you now have such a range of knowledge about cheese.
And if people want to participate in getting that knowledge, they can become part of your blog.
Blog, Madame Fromage. Try to update a few times a week on different cheeses that I'm trying or cheese events happening around the country.
Oh, that's good. Madame Fromage.
MadameFromageBlog.com.
Okay.
That's a final word for to Bruno, because you don't have to live in Philadelphia to use them, I think.
That's true.
We had several samples shipped to us, and I'm sure they must do a regular business in that. So how do people go about doing that?
You could visit the website, debruno.com, and they do all kinds of shipping around the country, various gift baskets and packages. You can search by particular cheeses that they'll ship overnight.
Now, all we have to do is we have to remind everybody, and we know this too, so cheese should be served at close to room temperature.
That's correct.
And the death of cheese is to have it in a refrigerator which is too cold.
Right.
And we were at a London restaurant several years ago, and I think they still have it. The cheese has its own refrigerator.
I've seen that.
Set at 55 degrees.
Yes.
And that's the way it ought to be. I would have it even stinkier if I could. we got two wheels of Point Reyes, the new Point Reyes cheese.
Oh, fantastic.
And I didn't refrigerate one of them at all.
Oh, good.
And boy, did it smell and taste good by the time I was done with it. Anyway, these tips and many more are in the book. They're available through MadameFromageBlog.com.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Tanaya Darlington, and the book is called De Bruno Brothers House of Cheese.
Thank you so much for your interest.
Yeah, well, it's a delightful book, and you are too. And good success, huh?
Thank you. I appreciate your cheese enthusiasm.
Absolutely.
Love cheese. Okay, thank you.
Were we right? It really is an interesting story. The whole program today has been a whole lot of interesting stories. I hope that you found them to be entertaining and informative. And that you'll join us again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.